Now it's rolling.
Hey everybody, David with Think and Act Locally. This is Eric Sanchez. He has something to share with us today. Buckle up, you're in for a ride. This is kind of an emergency pod. He had some things he wanted to get off his chest and let us know about. I'm going to take a sidestep on this one and let him just share with you.
Okay, thank you. So it's a very complicated set of events here, a story, but I felt like I have to elaborate kind of to explain how it all came about now in 2025. So pretty much in very short, I met this man named Richard Wayne Collins through my brother. My brother was in prison. And this man just asked for help with getting a book published. Thing I did a bunch of things to help him with that. And it was in the early 2000s, 2006, 7, and above. And my brother was doing 30 years for a homicide that he committed at age 17, which, you know, something that I think anyone would agree is excessive given the circumstances involved, like the person was a dangerous gang member and a drug dealer and suspected sexual predator. You know, I think there's a lot of mitigation factors that were ignored. And I've learned that that is true through a mitigation specialist that I met later on now. And this, you know, all this early experience of this, you know, really planted a lot of skepticism within me toward law enforcement, the prosecutors, and the judicial system. In 2015, I advocated for Collins' parole by submitting letters of support to the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles, and he got out. So everything was all and good, and he would work for me, help me out with work, and he rented a house or apartment with me. I rented it out to him, really, specifically. And in 2018, you know, Collins was just falsely accused of a terroristic threat by a woman attempting to seize control of the home they rented together. The woman fabricated allegations. Their allegations just collapsed when she just refused to testify, and, you know, then the case was finally dismissed. And they're very serious, you know, and she knew Collins was a parolee, and she used it against him. She claimed that he threatened to kill her and dismember her and bury her in the backyard, which is pretty crazy considering that Collins is pretty much... he wrote that novel in dedication for two victims of violent crime, and he doesn't believe in murder. He believes it's very wrong. And while incarcerated, Collins also provided FBI information about the murders that he confessed to me later on, that he knew this information as well. But to explain, he witnessed some stuff when he was 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 years old during those times. And he suppressed those memories. And which he gained those memories back when he saw the story of Amber Hagerman, her abduction. Amber Hagerman is the girl from the Amber Alerts, how it was developed. She's a cause of it. And her kidnapping and her murder have never been solved. The FBI did speak to Collins on his theories on his psychological profile in the 90s, but they didn't go anywhere as far as he knows. And, you know, another man, my brother in prison met in 2022, somewhere around there, told me about his wrongful conviction of a young girl, 9-year-old, that claimed that he had sexually abused her, and you can imagine what else. And obviously, this is very skeptical for me to, hard for me to believe. Because if you look at the, just the charge, everything just looks so serious. And, but, when I looked into all the information I could, everything I've obtained from his lawyer, who worked on his case, his innocence case, for the Innocence Project, and his lawyer really believed in his innocence. But he just couldn't help him, because the victim, now age 20 or 32, something like that, she had a Greek. She came forward willing to recant on her own volition. She dangled this over this man's head. His name is Mark Anthony Lasher, giving him all this hope that he'd finally be free for months. And then she finally got with the lawyer, met him up. She was there about to sign the recantment. And I'm assuming the lawyer either had a legal obligation, or in order to ensure the sworn affidavit of her recantment couldn't be called coercive or something, he showed her the interview. And when she was a child, whenever she spoke about the allegations. And then she just relapsed, started saying, "No, he's guilty, blah, blah, blah." And it was unfortunate because she was professing how innocent he was. And it was another man who did it. And in that case, I found there's literally no evidence against him other than her statement. And she didn't even appear. They used a video recorded statement. And her testimony, or her statements, even when she accused him, made no sense. She never articulated a correct date. She articulated dates where she was already in CPS custody. She gave contradictive statements. Never said a thing that made any sense. And even in trial, whenever it was pointed out, they just claimed it was just a small inconsistency because she was a child who didn't understand dates. Even though these dates were just between 5 days. It's between calling something on Monday, it's calling something on Sunday. It all happened Thanksgiving. She just said it happened after Thanksgiving, which was impossible because after Thanksgiving she was safe with CPS and another woman. And they still convicted him for life. Even though she clearly states a date that's impossible for her to have ever been assaulted, especially not at her home because she never went back home. She was with CPS. Yet, they just ignore all these parts and say, "No, he's guilty regardless. We don't care. We're going to trust a little girl," apparently. Even though the little girl couldn't be trusted, she lied about other people, and or at least they didn't pursue these other people, like 10 other people. She had been doing it for 2 years. Like, for attention, I don't know. But clearly, in all her psychological information was withheld, her medical information, where she had schizophrenia, would see angels, all this crazy stuff. Where they even withheld how she was actually molesting other kids. And even like her siblings, her cousins, nephews, family members. And somehow this man, Mark, is the one that goes to prison. Even though this little girl was the one doing that. And it was proven because she confessed to it. Not the stepmother, the foster mother that she was with. And all these things would have clearly proven there's so much doubt in this case. And he's still there in life in prison. Well, actually, I think he has a 99-year sentence. And they basically have implicitly said that they would grant him parole if he simply confessed to assaulting the girl. And he refuses to confess because he never did it. And that's a terrible thing to do to a person, to dangle freedom, or somewhat freedom, I guess, with the condition of confessing to something you never did. So, obviously, all these things make me seriously doubtful in the justice system. And additionally, even his lawyer, that was his last case. I think he'd be retired after that. Now he's dead, so he can't tell anybody what he did, because clearly looked like his lawyer just did nothing but make sure he lost. Similarly to another lawyer named Jerry Guerinot, which I will show, we'll talk about him later, maybe a little bit, but elaborate on him. But here is the timeline of the events of how all this culminated, beginning May 23rd, 2024. Right after midnight, right before midnight, May 22nd, Richard Wayne Collins was falsely arrested for alleged sexual assault. Initially believing the case could have been mistaken identity, I then realized otherwise after I was trying to submit exculpatory evidence, and the Harris County District Attorney staff were very hostile and made it clear to me that they were knowingly pursuing a wrongful conviction. They tried to detain me, they tried to grab me, they tried to put their hands on me. They said I was obstructing, I was interfering, when I literally just showed up in the only blazer I own, dressed formally, right, protected myself professionally. And these people freak out, and they bring two armed cops to try to intimidate me, side by side with this lady, some Hispanic lady, and she was wearing like a just professional little jacket thing, and muted colors like brownish, and she just was trying to make me leave, saying I had no business in the case. I told her that wasn't true. I was a material fact witness. I possessed the evidence that could prove his innocence, like where he was, his alibi, how the facts point to ridiculous, like just circumstances for him to somehow be able to, basically they said that he raped a lady, some elderly lady. It's like, how can he do that when he's at work across Houston? And he's going to somehow do this and make it and nobody notice. And it was all ridiculous. I'm obviously skipping a lot, but it was easier to prove he didn't do it than to prove that he could have done it. It was just easily proven that he just couldn't have done it. And, you know, it was worse because you think an attorney should be able to figure this out, even a court-appointed. But that's not true, because the court-appointed lawyer he got was a man named Jerry Guerino. He's widely regarded as the worst capital defense attorney in the United States, with 28 death penalty losses, 10 executions of his clients, and no successful sentence commutations. Even the New York Times wrote an article about him, and I have a sworn affidavit from a witness that I planted in the courtroom on the day of one of the court settings where he heard Jerry conspire with a prosecutor named Kaylee Veltri to force Collins to plea guilty, as he could not escape from the parole hold that they had on him. Pretty much this man swore that he heard him say something to the effect, I can't remember exactly right now, but when she approached him, the girl, the lady, Kaylee Veltri, she said, "Are you Mr. Collins' defense? Are you the one defending Collins?" And he took offense to this, which is also in the New York Times article. He said something very similar. He said, "Well, no. I mean, I'm not really defending him. I'm representing him." That's basically what he said. And he said the same thing in the New York Times article in like the year 2000 something. And he told her, "Don't worry, we got him on a blue warrant." And he's talking about the parole hold, where it makes it easy for them to get anybody. You basically have less rights. They don't have a duty to really show probable cause. I think really they mean they don't have to have a probable cause hearing the same way. It's more like someone has to swear to that they have evidence, which is what they swore. Detectives swore it to the Board of Pardons and Parole in order to obtain this warrant. It's called a parole warrant, parole revocation warrant. They didn't use a standard arrest warrant because they couldn't, because they didn't have evidence. But that's what I believe. That's the only reason you do that. If you claim you got DNA, that's all you need. You get it in a heartbeat. You just get it. So why is it that they went the other way and tried to get it with a cheap, flimsy parole violation? He got arrested for violating the law. That's it. He didn't get arrested for the crime. He got arrested for the violation caused by the committing the alleged crime. So it's just ridiculous. And this DNA profile, they said, was so powerful, so accurate. I mean, it was accurate down to 1 in 8 octillions for it to be wrong. Yet, they will not provide it. And I think it's because it doesn't exist. And that's the problem. These people never have to prove they have any evidence. They only have to say they have it, which is ridiculous. And at trial is whenever they present it. But that'll never happen. They'll never get caught lying, because the second you go to trial, right before you go to trial, they could dismiss the case, and that's it. It was all a big game of chicken. You'll never get it either, for the most part, because they will use every legal loophole to prevent you from getting it. Like, it's called Holmes v. Morales, where Johnny Holmes somehow inexplicably won this case whenever 14 people got together. I'm not sure exactly who they were, but they were trying to get these files. And I'm assuming they implicated the district attorney's office in some serious corruption. And he managed for the Supreme Court to rule that, ensure that anything in the prosecutor's file isn't really up for disclosure. So the second they put it in their file, you're done. You can't get it. There is ways to argue it. I don't know why these people lost their arguments. It just seems very suspicious. And which is very suspicious, because Jerry Guerinot also was referred to the Supreme Court in some capacity. I'm not super sure. It's kind of limited on the information, but he was getting, there were this lady named Linda Cardi, I believe. It was because of her that she did something, and they were referring it to the Supreme Court to review these serious allegations of him being ineffective. And they declined to review it. And they just made some kind of comment that, you know, his performance was less than perfect, but the Sixth Amendment or whatever it is that affords you the attorney, an attorney, doesn't say you need to get a perfect one. And it's like a gross mischaracterization, a false equivalency for him to say this. Just like completely ignoring the facts, making this very vague statement with a broad brushstroke. Basically, like, that wasn't the issue. It wasn't that he was less than perfect. It's that he didn't do shit. Like, he was crooked. He let people just lose. There's Linda Carter. She said that she only spoke to him for 15 minutes before her trial. That was it. And she lost. And there's a bunch of stuff he could have done to help her. And I do believe there's obviously a lot of evidence to show she was guilty of what she was accused of. But I believe they did that because there was some evidence that showed that they were overcharging her with a capital crime. She was guilty of, I think, kidnapping. The murder that she was used, it was used for her to get a death sentence. That, to me, was questionable, because it kind of seemed like she had no reason to kill someone at some point. It was very strange, if you look into her case. It sounds to me like some other person killed the person, and then they just made a plea deal to, you know, just whatever, to bail themselves out of it, and they stuck with that story that she killed the person, maybe. And what also leads me to believe this is because she's still not dead. They're like too afraid to execute her. Like the British, she was a British national, so the consulate got involved. They got upset that they weren't aware, they weren't made aware about her incarceration and her death sentence. They said that because they don't believe in the death penalty, that they would have done everything possible to give her a lawyer. And that said that the district attorney's office purposely hid this, all this going on, to prevent them from defending their own citizen or whatever. And they've never executed her. They haven't set up execution date. It's just like, she's a bad person. You know, like, I'm not going to say she's a good person, but why are they just going through all this trouble to just kill people indiscriminately? It just seems really, really stupid. So, and I'll explain more about the capital stuff in a bit. But, so, moving on. All this made me, I just kept digging. And this all made me very suspicious of, like, how blatantly obvious all this stuff was. It just seemed crazy. Like, come on. It's almost laughably. Like, it's just crazy. Like, it just doesn't make sense. So I kept looking into Richard's other documents. You know, because I noticed they kept repeatedly referencing a 1978 murder conviction Richard Wayne Collins had. And I've known about this since I met him. I never had asked him. I thought it was embarrassing or something. Like, it was it said he got 5 years for it, so I figured it must be for some kind of accidental fight where he killed someone on accident. But then that makes sense because it says murder, so no, that would have been like negligent homicide or something. So that didn't make any sense. I figured that he probably killed someone in self-defense in prison, or maybe someone who tried to molest him or rape him or something like that as a child or adult, or I guess teenager almost. He was like around 18 when that happened. So that's, I kind of figured maybe that's what happened. So I didn't ask him. When he did get arrested, all this happened, and my brother was looking for information because he was curious to know what was that conviction about. And he found some info from a podcast, which is crazy what he found. And then I finally just asked him, like, tell me what happened. Why do you have a murder conviction? Because I'm seeing that it says another guy killed this guy. I'm confused. And he explained to me the story. And his story lined up. After he told me, I even found a statement he made about the whole events that he talked about of June 15th, 1978. I made a video about it too. We'll probably link it here. But he told me his story, and it lined up even with that statement. That was 46 years ago. Like, almost word for word, he just still remembered it that well. Because he was traumatized as well, when you think about it. But his story didn't change. He did not give me no factual information that was wrong, according to his story. And so I let him know I found that statement. He didn't even know what existed, really. He looked at it. He says, it looks a little familiar, but a lot of it doesn't make sense. A lot of the statements he said are like really, really incomplete. And just, they all show the guilt of the killer, John Henry Quinones, but they don't show any of his innocence. Like, they cut all those parts off where he kept saying how he didn't want to be part of the crime. He was afraid for his life. He thought he'd kill him if he didn't comply by driving the getaway car, basically. They leave all that out. It's really frustrating. He looked at the signature on the statement, and he believes it's not even his signature. And we compared it to a different signature that he made in that year, and it's not the same. And so we kept investigating. I pulled the actual file, like the actual like paper file. It looks a bit different than that, but the file that was in the actual courtroom. And it had this fraudulent indictment, had his name scratched out, the name of the killer scratched out, his name on top of it. It was stupidly, blatantly illegal and fraudulent. And they ran with it. And it means every single person who ever handled his records, on every time he got another charge, whenever he got enhanced with this crime, they knew how bad it was. They knew it was fraudulent, and they kept their mouth shut. Even his defense attorney kept his mouth shut the last time. He remembers in 81, he mentioned that his indictment was no good. And when he tried to ask me to elaborate, he just kept it hush-hush and never brought it up again. So, it's just ridiculous. So, the coerced plea, they coerced the plea out of him, told him, sign for this 5 years, be happy it's five, it's a golden rainbow, it's a good opportunity to get out of this. Like, you'd be crazy to not sign it. That's what his attorney, defense attorney, Sam Adamu, said in 1978. He knew how illegal it was. He colluded with the prosecutors and the judge. The judge, his wife, was even the court reporter. That's ridiculous. Like, all these people were covering each other. And the judge, Sam Adamu, and the prosecutor, Russell G. Harding, or Russell Harding, and the other defense attorney for John Henry Quinones, his name was Stanley G. Schneider. He is still alive. You know, like, they saw this indictment. They all knew it was illegal. Like, maybe people are thinking I'm scared to say that out loud, that I'm somehow defrauding or defaming them or whatever. It's just obviously true. You can see it. I'm not afraid of, like, them saying whatever, like, trying to silence me. At least not legally. I mean, they could try to kill a person. I believe they could. I think they're capable of killing me if they wanted to. I don't think they would now. I don't think it's just too late. Because all these modern ways of getting this information, now they just can't even. It's out there too much. Back then, in the 60s, in the 70s, 80s, they probably could get away with killing people. They probably did. Plenty of times they probably killed people. So. And the transcript of John Henry Quinones' trial, that's missing. It's nowhere to be found, which has never been, that's never happened in the history of the United States. The Court of Criminal Appeals tells me they don't have it, even though they have some kind of record of the opinion from it, because there's an opinion of it. They mention things that only the transcript will show. So I don't understand. I spoke to a witness, a person who testified, allegedly. She tells me she has no idea why it says that, because she never testified. That's impossible. So I don't know if she's lying to me. I don't get it. But it does even tell you, it blatantly says that Richard Wayne Collins exercised his Fifth Amendment right. He said something like that. It sets up that in the motion for a new trial of John Henry Quinones, that they violated his rights by not letting him confront his accuser, Rachel Wayne Collins. And it's like, yeah, he is right. And also, you can't just not show up by basically pleading the Fifth and just, I'm not showing up to court. That's not legal at all. You have to show up. You can plead the Fifth and sit there and not want to talk, fine. But Collins should have been there, and Collins was never called to court. Ever. He's like, no, I never went to trial, to his trial. And I believe, I know why, because they were hiding both of them. They both put him under John Henry Quinones' identity. One was in one city, in one jail, and one was in the other jail, and it kept him hidden from everyone. And effectively, for a month or two, about 2 months, there was two men named John Henry Quinones sitting in Texas custody, fraudulently, just completely, just illegally doing this stuff. And they covered their asses right at the last minute when they told him to plea. He pled. He confessed to a murder he never committed, directly saying he killed the guy, even though the guy was killed with one bullet, one gun. Doesn't make sense. And they know it's true. Even the autopsy confirms he was killed with one bullet, one gun. They never found the bullet for some reason, which I think is ridiculous, because he shot him in the back of the head, face down on the ground. So, come on. So, and then after he pled, they made a motion to, a request, I guess you'd call it, to change the name on the indictment to read Richard Wayne Collins. And, like, what the hell? But he signed it already. Like, come on, like, it's stupid. It was just all a big game to them. They didn't care about putting a person in prison for 5 years. They didn't care. They did anything to cover their asses, because had Richard Wayne Collins testified, he'd be able to prove that not only was he innocent, or if he testified at John King Owens' trial, he'd prove he was innocent, yes, and also prove that they were lying about even his trial for no reason. They had no reason to lie. All they had to do, this guy killed this guy, here's a weapon, this guy helped us, awesome. And they refused to do that. They refused to give him credit. They refused to let some criminal to them, you know, he had like a felony case before that. He was on parole. They refused to let a parolee take credit for catching a murderer. And I believe it might be a serial killer, to be honest. I found other evidence of stuff. But they refused to let him get the credit, I guess. Because he even told them about an armed robbery that John Henry had committed. And they got him on that one. And the detective never said where he got the info from. He just acted like he was Sherlock Holmes and actually solved the case. He just acted like he was Sherlock Holmes and acted like he solved the case or something. It's stupid. And they just could have done the right thing. Instead, they go and stab him in the back and say he killed the guy too. And violate his rights just to like get a sweet, easy conviction, which is sick. They didn't have to do that. But if Richard Wayne Collins had testified, he would have said, yeah, I gave him the gun. I called the cops. They came to the hotel I was at. I told them I had been confused. I had been drugged or I had been whatever. And I don't remember where the gun came from. It just appeared there. I wanted to take it away. I have nothing to do with it. And he told them that his car was missing and his wallet was gone. And that was true. He was written down as a complainant and a victim of a robbery, basically. And cops checked out the gun. It was not reported stolen. They checked out, you know, Collins. He had no warrants. He was clean. They had not detained him. They gave him a ride to the station because he couldn't be left at the hotel, I guess, while they were doing all this. They were checking, calling his mom, ringing his plates, all this stuff. And then called the mom to pick him up. She said, all right, I mean, I guess. And basically, she said, oh, you know, his car is actually here. And I don't know why it's here, but it's here. But she knew why. She knew that John Henry had driven it back to his house when he saw the cops were at the motel or hotel. And he thought that Collins got busted or something, but he didn't. He didn't get busted at all. And he just kept lying about it. He claimed he was busted on a secret recording, but really nothing happened. He never got busted for anything. He just went home after that. He laid low somewhere. He called the police, the detectives actually. So not the police for that, the detectives who were investigating the murder, because he saw a newspaper clipping with the number. And this, I found the Houston Chronicle clipping where he read it, and it's true. The dates match up. His statement is correct. And he told them what he knew, blah, blah, blah. So if he would have told all this information in trial, or even parts of it, which were open to be talked about, especially with the recording that he later made of John Henry confessing to the murder, basically admitting he killed the guy, it would have shown that the cops just lied about the narrative, because they claimed they arrested him that June 17th, 1978 for unrelated charges and were questioning him, and like he was interrogated and cracked and confessed to the murder and handed the pistol over to them. Which is not true at all, because the HPD call for service for June 17, 1978, that I acquired in 2025, after a lot of requests, and they kept denying me that it existed, but I found it. And that call for service shows how he was telling the truth, how he voluntarily gave the gun to them. He called them to pick it up, He was not a suspect. He was just a complainant. And they suppressed this even in John Henry's trial. They wouldn't give it to him. They wouldn't show him how they obtained the gun, the chain of custody, basically. And that's, John even says that in his motion for new trial. And even in 1981, the aggravated robbery arrest that Richard Wayne Collins was convicted of, that one was also bad. Like, they had no proof, they had nothing, they were just going off of hearsay, the person couldn't identify who robbed them. It was all stupid. And some guy that he knew confessed to doing it and implicated him in it. And basically he lost that trial. He was sentenced to life in prison. But it was overturned on appeal. And we believe not only because they had improperly using enhancement that he was under appeal for. Some like theft enhancement or something, felony theft or whatever it was. They used that enhancement. It was under appeal, and which is illegal. So they had to reverse it all. By the time they reversed it, somebody, it would have been 2.5 years. They just called it time served. Get out of here. And I'm sure that pissed off Pasadena because they're the ones that made the arrest. So that was all good. And later on in 1990, unfortunately, it's almost like they conspired to do this. Some undercover an informant befriended Collins and convinced them of, hey, let's hit up, let's do this lick, whatever. And he said he had plans, he had keys, access to like a pharmacy or something, and to rob it. And he talked him into it, basically pretty much coerced Collins into it, and then set him up in a sting operation, and they arrested him, and then he got a life in prison. Which is like, come on. Like, that's how you're going to get a guy life in prison, by something that you orchestrate like a big task force on? Like, that just seems very, very targeted. It really does. I don't know how else to think of that. I can't find who that guy is either. I'm sure he used a different name. But, and then Collins, like I spoke earlier, where he said that he had remembered witnessing some crimes. He's never really talked about it. He remembers seeing that they killed a few people, buried them under his house. He knows where the house is. I've tried to reach out to the owners or past owners, made just simple, very innocent inquiries just to see the history or speak about the history of the house. Not even to like blatantly tell them anything. And they refuse to talk to me. They block my calls. They don't answer. They're acting very suspicious. I don't know. And I call them with my phone, showing my name. I'm not hiding anything. I'm not being suspicious. And maybe I'll contact them better soon. I don't know. But he remembered some little girl around the 1960s, early 1960s. He was a young kid. He don't remember how old he was, but that they abducted this little girl around Franklin Elementary off of Canal Street and off of the corner of 72nd and Canal and or the next street above Canal. There's like a small street, the corner of that park area. So they just kidnapped her and took her out by Rice University. Back when it was, I guess, under construction, kind of, I don't know. It was very rural, kind of a little bit there. And they had raped her. It was like two family members of his, or step-family members, because he was adopted by people after his mom died when he was 2 years old. And he has a strong reason to believe they killed her. So this other step-family he had, the new step-family he had, pretty much he's saying that they were serial killers. And one of their family members was like, he worked for HPD. And I did find the records of him. He did work for HPD. And he just helped them cover up murders. Like nothing. A few $100 and he'd cover up a murder for you. He'd just pull the file and destroy it. Because it was easy. And he just knows that they killed this girl, raped her, dumped her somewhere by Rice University. And that was it. And they might have found her body a few years later. He remembers hearing them speak about it, like they read it on the newspaper. But that was it. He doesn't know. I can't find any info on it. He can't find info on it of who that could have been. I can't find any reports. I don't know. It was very easy to hide stuff like that back then. But he was like 7 or 9 years old, and they killed her. And there's another, a similar circumstance of Maggie McNatt, a man that I also have been helping. But he was a cop, and he went to a crime scene. A young African-American girl was killed, raped, murdered. It was very disturbing. It really, really affected him. And he documented the crime scene, wrote either the whole report or some of the report, and he, I'm about to take this call.
All phone calls are subject to monitoring and recording.
Hey, can you pause it? So, because I got to take this call. It's one of the guys.
Yeah.
Hey, so... yeah, I was recording something, but what's up?
No, it's okay.